Eugene Wells Jr. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Time for the evening news.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center in Portland. Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, is a public talk by Grace Kim about the loneliness epidemic in Portland and how co-housing can help. Grace is a principal at Skamata Workshop and a co-founder of Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing in Seattle. The talk is part of the National Co-Housing Conference taking place in Portland, May 30th through June 2nd. Again, that's Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, an update from environmental activist Lena Westland about the Youth Climate Action lawsuit.
Mayor Ted Wheeler appoints Jamal Fox as his deputy chief of staff.
And in international news, dozens of fires are burning in Canada's Alberta province and 10,000 people have been evacuated.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, May 31st, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Oregon Manufacturers and Commerce filed a referendum yesterday to repeal the $1 billion tax for schools that state lawmakers approved last week. The Alliance of Corporations must collect 75,000 signatures within 90 days after the end of the legislative session to put the tax on the ballot. The law, which has already been signed by Governor Kate Brown, raises taxes on big business to bring in $2 billion in each two-year budget cycle. The state's largest business organization, Oregon Business and Industry, made a deal with legislative Democrats to cut back parts of the tax in exchange for the association agreeing not to fight it at the ballot box, but many businesses still oppose the tax. The repeal referendum filed with the Oregon Secretary of State repeals the tax, but not the spending or a modest cut in personal income tax designed to offset the effects of the business tax on shoppers. The Oregonian reported this week that opponents are suggesting lawmakers should find the money for schools within the existing state budget, but they don't say where they should look for the funds.
Democrats in the Oregon legislature have failed to prioritize a Senate bill to strengthen Oregon's hate crime statute. The Willamette Week reports that Senator Betsy Johnson of Scappoose, Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward of Beaverton, and Representative Dan Rayfield, all Democrats, chair the Joint Ways and Means Committee and have failed to move the bill forward. Senate Bill 577 would make bias-motivated crimes a felony under Oregon law. Currently, hate crimes in Oregon come under the charge of intimidation, and it's considered a misdemeanor. A bill would add gender identity to the list of protected traits in Oregon and would require the state to track hate crimes more consistently. The bill would also allocate about $670,000 to fighting hate and establish a dedicated hate crimes hotline for victims, among other things. According to Willamette Week, the hate crime legislation is not on a list of bills to be funded in 2019 and is at risk of stalling out in the budget process, which ends this week. The legislation is supported by Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, who asked for the bill this session, and many high-ranking Democrats, including House Majority Leader Jennifer Williamson of Portland. At a public hearing in March, the bill had no registered opposition.
The state of Oregon is about to limit the circulation of single-use plastic straws. House lawmakers voted yesterday to prohibit restaurants from providing plastic straws to customers unless they ask, something the city of Portland already does. The Senate has approved the bill, but the House chamber must approve a technical change to it before it hits the desk of Oregon Governor Kate Brown. Willamette Week reported earlier this year that environmentalists stopped supporting the straw ban because the bill was amended to take control over the policy out of the hands of local communities. So far, only California has taken a move to restrict single-use plastic straws statewide.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has appointed Jamal Fox as his deputy chief of staff. Fox is a former Greensboro, North Carolina City Council member. In 2013, he was the youngest person ever elected to the council at the age of 25. He resigned midway through his second term in 2017. Recently, Fox moved to Portland to take a job as property and business development manager with the Parks Bureau. Fox was a plaintiff in a gerrymandering lawsuit against the state of North Carolina, which alleged Republican legislators had packed voting districts to limit the power of African Americans. The case was eventually argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, which found that Republican lawmakers had drawn voting maps to weaken black presidents' electoral influence.
And City Commissioner Chloe Udaly announced yesterday Chris Warner has been appointed the new director of the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Warner has served as the interim director since July of last year after the previous director, Leah Treat, stepped down from the position. Warner brings 20-plus years of public management and transportation expertise to the position. Prior to receiving the new title, he did policy work for numerous politicians, including City Commissioner Steve Novick, former Governor Ted Kulongoski, and Senator Ron Wyden. In her statement to the public, Udaly wrote, quote, "I chose Warner because he shares my commitment to safety, equity, and sustainability, as do most Portlanders."
Washington State champion runner Rosie Fish has caused a sensation by winning 3 out of 4 races at state championships that were held over the Memorial Day weekend in Auburn. Fish won her races with the letters MMIW written in red on her leg and a red handprint across her face, drawing attention to the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women locally and around the continent. A senior at Muckleshoot Tribal School and a member of the Cowlitz tribe, Fish dedicated each of her 4 races to a different Indigenous woman. 2 had been murdered without any perpetrator arrested, and 2 were shot to death by police. The Yakima Herald reported this week that Fish created posters telling the stories of the women on which she hung her 3 gold medals and 1 silver. Indigenous women across North America are murdered at higher rates than any other racial or ethnic minority. Oregon passed a law last week allocating more resources in fighting violent crime against Indigenous women here, and a similar bill is working its way through the Washington State Legislature. Fish told the Herald that she reached out to another runner, Jordan Marie Brings, 3 White Horses Daniel, who ran the Boston Marathon with the red handprint across her face.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An Ontario First Nation has declared a state of emergency due to a wildfire. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, officials are working to evacuate hundreds of people.
Seniors and those in wheelchairs will be the first to board a C-130 Hercules transport plane. There are about 2,300 people living in Pikangikum, a remote reserve hundreds of miles northwest of Thunder Bay in northern Ontario. More than half of them have been identified as vulnerable. Indigenous leaders declared the state of emergency because of a nearby fire and the smoke. The city of Thunder Bay is preparing to receive about 300 of the evacuees over the next 2 days. It will also act as a transportation hub to help move many who have fled to other host communities. Meanwhile, more than a dozen fire crews are trying to contain the fire east of Pikangikum. It's already burned through about 1,000 acres of forest. Officials say so far it's burning away from the community, but that could change dramatically if the wind shifts. The Assembly of First Nations says it will do whatever it can to help. And in Ottawa, Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale says the government has staff working to coordinate the federal response. But some Native leaders say they're frustrated with the government's response so far. Grand Chief Alvin Fiddler of the Anishinaabe Nation says it's been too slow. He says his officials have been in contact with the government since late Wednesday to try to get a quicker reaction, just knowing the scope of the emergency and the number of people that have to be moved. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In Oklahoma, communities are continuing assessments and recovery efforts from recent storms. The Muscogee Creek Nation declared an emergency this week due to heavy rain and flooding, which has impacted property of tribal citizens, as well as tribal offices and businesses, including the closure of the River Spirit Casino. Officials estimate the casino resort will remain closed in June due to concerns of water levels on the Arkansas River. The Cherokee Nation's emergency management team has been working to help tribal citizens and their neighbors. The tribes are working with local, state, and other agencies on recovery efforts. Longtime New Mexico State Senator John Pinto was laid to rest Thursday. Family, friends, tribal leaders, and the public attended services for Pinto in the city of Gallup. His granddaughter, Kelly Arviso, delivered the eulogy, saying Pinto never gave up and was a hard worker.
He would work late nights and early mornings, getting up as early as 3 in the morning during session. He'd push for those 4 a.m. calls, and then he'd pause to even call you at 6 or 7 a.m. just to say hi. You would hear him in his sleep talking about this bill or that bill, or occasionally singing a song or two. As he got older, his commitment did not waver. Rather, the room lights got brighter and the words on the paper got bigger, but the stack of paper never got smaller.
Pinto served in the Senate for more than 40 years, was a Navajo co-talker, and a lifelong advocate for Native American issues. He passed away last week at age 94. Alaska is celebrating Katie John Day. Legislation to establish the holiday on May 31st states it's a day to honor Otna Athabascan elder Katie John. John, who passed away in 2013 at age 97, was a lifelong advocate for Native rights. She's well known for fighting for Alaska Native hunting and fishing rights. Members of her family were present for the bill signing ceremony with the state on Thursday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. At 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6:30, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, the struggle with Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Tonight's weather, we're going to have clear skies, low around 55. And tomorrow, a beautiful day, sunny, high of 82. Saturday night, going to be partly cloudy and 55 once again. Today in history, in 1962, Adolf Eichmann, a former officer in the SS, was executed by hanging in Tel Aviv. Eichmann was found guilty of 15 counts, including crimes against humanity and genocide. The quote of the day is from professor, activist, Holocaust survivor, and author Elie Wiesel. For me, every hour is grace, and I feel gratitude in my heart each time I can meet someone and look at his or her smile. And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
The year was 1921. That was the day one of the worst race riots in American history began in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In a frenzy of anti-black violence, a white mob destroyed virtually the entire black neighborhood of Greenwood. Over the course of the next 2 days, as many as 300 mostly black residents were killed. Black Wall Street had been burned to the ground, leaving 10,000 homeless. The day before, Dick Rowland, a young black man, tripped as he boarded an elevator at his job. He fell against the young white woman elevator operator. When she shrieked, nearby department store employees assumed she had been assaulted. Rowland was arrested, and newspapers fanned the flames of race violence and vigilantism. And on this day, white racist mobs surrounded the Tulsa County Courthouse, where Rowland was being held, and demanded he be turned over to them. Returning black veterans had become increasingly assertive about their rights as citizens. They marched to the courthouse armed in an attempt to prevent Rowland's lynching. When the vets refused to disarm in the face of the demands by the white mob, gunfire ensued, touching off 16 hours of fighting that literally decimated the community black workers and professionals had built up over the course of decades. The National Guard was called out, mainly to disarm and round up black residents of Greenwood. Witnesses reported that Greenwood was bombed from the air by police and by Sinclair Oil Company planes. The history of the riot was buried for more than half a century. It would take until 1997 for the Oklahoma State Legislature to set up a commission to uncover the bloody details, which produced a 200-plus page report and recommended millions in reparations. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The state of California has fined the Los Angeles Police Department for rodent infestations and other poor conditions. Just 2 weeks before, an employee at a downtown Los Angeles station contracted typhoid fever. The California Department of Industrial Relations issued 6 violations and a $5,425 fine on May 14th. However, inspections of the Central Division facility in November revealed that the LAPD did not train employees about how a dangerous bacterial disease is transmitted, also didn't train them about the symptoms or measures for prevention. The department also did not have a program to exterminate and control rats, fleas, roaches, gnats, mosquitoes, or grasshoppers in the building, which inspectors found in the facility. Other violations came from failing to clean dust, dirt, suspect mold, and fungus from HVAC registered within a reasonable time, also for using extension cords instead of fixing wiring in the detectives' area, and for not keeping the parking garages, stairwells, and records rooms clean. The state also issued 2 citations for a total of $1,910 to the Department of General Services for not maintaining the building. The department submitted an appeal to the state on Tuesday. It's not clear whether the conditions cited by the state were connected to the employee's illness, but the action by the state came months after a vermin infestation at City Hall caused health concerns. One city employee was diagnosed with typhus, a disease that can be spread by rodents. LAPD said it was reviewing the report and working to make the Central Division cleaner.
A Department of Homeland Security inspector has found dangerous overcrowding and standing room only conditions at the El Paso del Norte Processing Center. The center has a maximum capacity of 125 migrants. However, logs indicated that there were between 750 and 900 detainees. According to the findings, a cell which normally holds a capacity of 12 people was holding 76 detainees. Another cell with a maximum capacity of 35 held 155 people. Detainees were also seen standing on toilets inside the cells to allow for more breathing room, which created limited access to toilets. Customs and Border Protection agents were having a hard time maintaining proper hygiene conditions in the cells. Limited access to showers and clean clothing resulted in detainees wearing soiled clothing for weeks. The Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General stated in its report that, quote, corrective action is critical to the immediate health and safety needs of detainees who cannot continue to be held in standing room only conditions for weeks until additional tents are constructed.
The famously homophobic president of the Philippines said yesterday that he used to be gay, but that he cured himself. While delivering a speech in Japan, Rodrigo Duterte mocked his political opponent for, quote, moving like a homosexual. Then he confessed he too used to be gay, but, quote, cured himself, according to the citizen journalist website Rappler. Duterte said he was cured of queerness before meeting his ex-wife Elizabeth Zimmerman. She filed for divorce in 1998, arguing in court that her husband was a womanizer. In the past, Duterte accused other political figures of being gay, including U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg, Philippines Human Rights Commission Chair Chito Gascon, and more recently, Philippine Senator Antonio Trillanes. He's also come out in favor of marriage equality, and with his recent remarks, he swears he has no problem with people being gay. He said in his speech this week, quote, Duterte is gay. I'm gay. I do not have that kind of anxiety.
The children's lawsuit against climate change is kicking into a new phase. KBOO News spoke with a key organizer about what's coming up next. We are speaking with Lena Westland. She's with Youth Rising for Environmental Action. This group of kids is basically behind one of the most important lawsuits anywhere, Juliana versus United States, described as the most important climate case of this generation. And Lena, this case is really, it's really heating up. Describe what this lawsuit is about. Let's just start there.
So Juliana, who the case is named after, is a young lawyer who, along with 20 other youth plaintiffs, filed a lawsuit against the federal government. I apologize, I just walked upstairs. So our complaint asserts that through the government's affirmative actions that cause climate change, it has violated the youngest generation's constitutional right to life, liberty, and property, as well as failed to protect essential public trust resources. Now, on June 4th, here in Portland, at the Pioneer Courthouse, there will be a hearing before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This will decide if the case will finally go to trial. It will also decide whether or not to cease creation of new federally approved fossil fuel infrastructure in the U.S. The appellate court can also order the federal government to halt new fossil fuel extraction projects while it decides the case. That would mean no new federal leases for offshore oil and gas exploration, no new federal permits for coal mining on federal land, and no new federal approvals for expanding facilities for fossil fuel extraction. As you can imagine, this win would be a huge step in the right direction for the future of our planet.
Can you give us a little bit of history? When was the lawsuit first filed?
Yeah, of course. So in 2015, youth filed a constitutional climate lawsuit called Juliana v. U.S. in the District Court for the District of Oregon. The fossil fuel industry initially intervened in the case as defendants, joining the U.S. government in trying to have the case dismissed. The federal government worked to stop them at every step and failed. However, they did succeed in delaying the trial, which did not begin on February 5th as originally scheduled, and is now, as I said before, taking place on Tuesday, June 4th, so this coming Tuesday.
Who's with you in the lawsuit? Who's participating in it? And who has helped you with it?
Okay. So I am organizing a press conference, which is tomorrow, for this lawsuit. And there's me and a few other students from St. Mary's Academy. Also, my friend Jackson Calhoun, who has been instrumental in planning the press conference. Our Children's Trust has been very helpful in guiding us on how to put on this conference, given that I'm 16 and I've never done anything like this before. Future Coalition, who is working with our Children's Trust, has also given us crucial advice and support.
Lena, what do you hope to achieve over the long term?
So I hope to achieve education for everyone about climate change. And I hope that this trial happens, and I hope that the plaintiffs and Juliana succeed in their efforts to help the planet, and that more youth get involved in trying to save our planet. And truly, it is our generation. It is our job, and we need to get involved. So I'm just trying to inspire others to help me in this fight.
All right. So for people who are listening to this interview right now, what do you need them to do to support your work?
So primarily just educate yourself, not only about the Juliana v. U.S. case, but climate change in general. It can be as simple as paying attention to the news or watching documentaries on Netflix. You can also join local climate change organizations. I'm part of Sunrise, a youth-led climate justice organization that recently opened a hub here in Portland. This organization is full of amazing people who are coming together to make a difference and empower young people to take charge of the climate fight. You can also sign up to be a part of the next Juliana Friend of the Court amicus brief at www.joinjuliana.org. Another great way to get involved is to contact your congressperson and ask them to publicly come out in support of Juliana and your constitutional rights.
Lena, who inspires you in this work? Because we've seen amazing leadership by very young people in the climate extinction movement, the struggle against global warming. But who inspires you?
Recently, I watched Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's video called A Message from the Future. She has been such an inspiration for me. And in this video, she describes what our future could look like if we implemented the Green New Deal. So along with her narration in the video, there was beautiful artwork. It was truly inspiring, and it gave me hope and further motivation to continue the work that I and other young people are doing. Another person I find truly inspiring is Greta Thunberg. She is a young Swedish woman who I believe is 15 years old. She began protesting about the need for immediate action to combat climate change outside the Swedish parliament, and has since become a very important climate activist. And I also believe that she recently became the youngest person to ever be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So she's truly an inspiration to all of us.
I have to ask you the tough question.
What has been your biggest obstacle so far?
Honestly, or just organizing this press conference. I signed up to do it 2 weeks ago, and managing all of this is totally new experience for me. And on top of everything at school and friends and just, you know, daily life, that has been very challenging but very exhilarating. And I truly feel like I'm making a difference and putting in my share of the work to help our planet.
Now I want to ask, is there anything about this situation, the lawsuit, the actions that you're taking, the press conference, that you think it's really important that I have not asked you yet? Am I leaving anything out?
I would say go and read the Green New Deal. You can find it online. This climate bill is so important, and along with the Giuliani case, it's definitely one of the most important actions and legislations that people are taking in the climate world right now. So definitely do everything that you can to try and get it passed and support the bill, and this includes voting for officials who support the Green New Deal.
One last time, can you tell us how to connect with Sunrise PDX that you said had just formed here? It just sounds really interesting. I'd never heard of it.
Yes, of course. You can just Google Sunrise Climate Organization, and then it should take you directly to a place to put in your email, and they will send you emails about ways to get involved. Because it is a new hub, they are actively looking for people to join, so they make it especially easy for you to get involved.
Lena Westlund, Youth Rising for Environmental Action, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us today. For KABU News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Smoke from a distant fire. In this case, Canada's Alberta province has drifted into Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Washington State, and Wyoming, touching off haze and air quality issues. More than 24 fires are burning in Alberta, and 10,000 people have been forced from their homes. The government agency Alberta Wildfire reports the largest blaze is out of control about 450 miles north of Edmonton and has burned 887 square miles of land. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency rated Helena's air quality as unhealthy Friday morning, while the air quality in Montana cities of Great Falls and Lewiston was rated as unhealthy for sensitive groups such as people with asthma or heart disease.
And Britain has hit a new record of not using coal to generate electricity for 2 weeks. This marks the longest period that coal has not helped power Britain since the Industrial Revolution. For 336 hours, the country was using other sources of energy, such as nuclear, solar, wind, gas, and wood pellets. Since the beginning of May, Britain has run coal-free for over 600 hours. That compares with only 624 coal-free hours in the whole of 2017. The UK is becoming a leader in offshore wind power and aims to close all unabated coal plants by 2025. Renewable UK's Deputy Chief Executive Emma Pinchbeck says, quote, "Coal was the backbone of the last industrial revolution, but this old technology is being beaten by wind energy, the powerhouse of our 21st century economy. Renewables are providing well over a third of our electricity today, and this is just the beginning."
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, May 31st, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kelly Jeffers and Kenzie Beard. The producer is Tammy Habdeus, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
I'm Lisa Loving. Coming up on Monday on KABU Morning Public Affairs at 7 a.m., of course, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Then at 8 a.m., more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste.
At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein at 10 a.m. and the Noontime Jamboree. You cannot forget that show. That's it for us. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Ray.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, quaint as it may sound, the idea is still operative for many people that if you work, you earn wages and fair treatment. We can't seem to shake the storyline that employers graciously offer this and workers should gratefully accept it. But a new report outlines just how tilted the workplace balance of power has become in this country and what we need to do to restore workers' voice and power at work. Titled Unchecked Corporate Power, Forced Arbitration, The Enforcement Crisis, and How Workers Are Fighting Back, the report comes from the Center for Popular Democracy and the Economic Policy Institute. We'll